Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bombshell dropped today by Senator Dianne Feinstein, who unilaterally released the transcripts of the testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee by the co-founder of Fusion GPS, which the chairman, Senator Grassley, has been sitting on. One of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations, Locke Johnson, the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, who served as staff director of the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss this uncharacteristically bold move by Senator Feinstein. We will look into how both Senator Grassley and Senator Graham have been going out of their way to divert attention from the evidence of collusion between Trump and the Russians and possible compromise Putin has on Trump in the Steele dossier. Instead, they are reinvestigating Hillary Clinton's emails and the bogus Uranium One story while going after the messenger by instigating a criminal investigation into Steele in the hope of preventing the message from getting to the American people. Then we'll examine President Trump's amazingly light work days revealed today in a scoop by Axios, who managed to get a copy of this week's private presidential schedule, which shows that most of the day Trump is engaged in what is euphemistically referred to as executive time, meaning he's watching cable television, calling friends on the phone, and tweeting. Matthew Dalek, a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management and a political historian, joins us to discuss how little Trump works governing the country compared to his predecessors and how dangerously ill-informed Trump is because he watches so much of Fox News. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University and author of Twilight of American Sanity. A psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump. He joins us to discuss how the new book, Fire and Fury, adds to the problem that there is too much focus and expectation being placed on the wish to remove Trump from office because he is mentally unfit, while not enough attention is paid to the fact that Trump is a very bad man doing very bad things to the country and the world, and he's only just getting started. Joining us now is Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as an assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He is the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon, and his latest book just out is Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Locke. And it's been an amazingly busy day for news. It's been coming thick and fast with Sheriff Arpaio announcing that he's running for the United States Senate in Arizona. Stephen Bannon's been forced out as head of Breitbart by his former financial patron, Rebecca Mercer. And the biggest bombshell of all is that Dianne Feinstein unilaterally released transcripts of the Fusion GPS founder's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee that Senator Grassley, the chairman, had been sitting on. I find that pretty extraordinary and perhaps even uncharacteristic of hers. She has a reputation for being somewhat cautious and a team player, but this is a pretty bold act, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And, you know, I'm a great fan of Senator Feinstein. But it is true that, say, 5 years ago, she was quite cautious and indeed viewed as something of a protector of the intelligence community. For example, when the stories came out about the National Security Agency and its various efforts to engage in the collection of metadata and other programs that were quite questionable, she was right behind the NSA and refused to, at first, to let the truth come out inside secret meetings, supported the NSA program. But then she had an epiphany, I think. She was next involved in looking at whether or not the CIA had been engaged in torture. And to her horror, she found out not only had it been engaged, but the torture went way beyond anything that she and most of us had even thought possible. And she got into a huge fight, you may recall, with the CIA and the White House over publishing the details of the agency's torture program. And I think that made her extremely skeptical, not to say hostile, toward the intelligence community for misleading her on that point.
Well, this, of course, is a different committee, the Judiciary Committee. But yes. I think what's really been bothering her is that both the chair, Senator Grassley, and the subcommittee chair, Lindsey Graham, have basically been going after Christopher Steele, the main source for the Steele dossier, mm-hmm. which was put together by Fusion GPS, and going after Hillary Clinton's emails yet again, and this bogus Uranium One story. I suspect, you know, she's been complaining to Grassley and to Senator Graham, who, you know, was a very acerbic critic of Trump, and then suddenly overnight seemed to have changed into something of a sycophant. So there's something going on there as well.
Well, I think she had a very similar experience on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which was led by Senator Burr of North Carolina, and she really got into a spat with him over releasing documents, and he was so much in bed with the administration at the time, the Obama administration, but more directly trying to help the CIA muffle the criticism of the torture program. So that was her first real battle with a fellow colleague. She was the leading Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, and Burr was the leading Republican. And now she finds the same thing going on the Judiciary Committee, and I think she's just about had it with Republicans trying to bottle up investigative findings and engage in these diversionary activities.
Well, this is clearly a bombshell, and Senator Feinstein said after speaking with majority and minority committee staff for 10 hours, Glenn Simpson, co-founder of Fusion GPS, requested the transcripts of his interviews to be released publicly. The American people deserve the opportunity to see what he said and judge for themselves. The innuendo and misinformation circulating about the transcripts are part of a deeply troubling effort to undermine the investigation into potential collusion and obstruction of justice. The only way to set the record straight is to make the transcripts public. So she's done that. We haven't, I certainly haven't had time to read it all, but what's being mentioned already in the press is that one of the nuggets in it is that apparently there's a mole inside the Trump, either both the campaign and the White House, but certainly the campaign, that was a walk-in to the FBI.
Yes.
And basically it was motivated in the way that Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort and Jared Kushner should have been motivated. When you're approached by Russian intelligence, you're supposed to report that to the FBI, and they didn't. But this person apparently did. So what do you make of that?
Well, it's all unfolding like a very bad but at the same time scary novel. And each day there's a new revelation. That's why we have great hope that the special counsel, Mueller, who's looking into this whole subject, will be able to report to us, because I think we have a lot of confidence in his past record, and he's liable to put the facts on the table. Until then, we're going to get a lot of interesting innuendo, and we never know exactly what's true and what's not. There is an interesting procedural issue that arises, though, from Senator Feinstein, whom, as I mentioned, is someone I admire greatly, releasing this testimony on her own volition, if that's the case, because that would be quite extraordinary for a member of a committee to do that if the testimony has been classified in any way, which I presume it has. So that's another sidebar here that one ought to consider. I think her intentions were right, and we do need to know, but whether or not an individual member of a committee like that without any formal clearance can release a testimony on her own right is an interesting question.
I think actually it's sort of worse than that, isn't it, in the sense that it looks like this meeting at Camp David over the weekend, the Republican leadership decided to go all in with Donald Trump and, in fact, join in the efforts to thwart, frustrate, sabotage, or even kill the Mueller investigation. They're already purging the FBI with absurd charges that they're a bunch of closet liberals in the FBI. And the other, they're going after the DOJ, which Trump refers to as the deep state DOJ. So as a longtime government insider, Locke, how do you think the rank and file in the FBI and the DOJ, and in the FBI in particular, having their personal emails and texts rifled through by people like Devin Nunes?
Well, I think they must be utterly appalled, and I can understand why. After all, these are men and women of the highest character and integrity, carefully screened to join the FBI and very much dedicated to law enforcement and also to make sure that we have the best intelligence we can find about Russian meddling or terrorist activities in this country. So they do noble work and often under dangerous circumstances, and for this kind of activity to be directed against them is really quite appalling. I'm also in agreement with you about the Republicans seeming to, at least the ones in Washington, gathering together and trying to defend the White House on a lot of questions that seem almost indefensible. And I've seen this happen before. I think the Republicans rallied against Dianne Feinstein when she tried to expose a terrorist report. I know when I was an aide to Frank Church, we were looking into CIA domestic spying. The Ford White House and the intelligence agencies tried to rally against us to destroy that investigation, which they failed in doing. So one sees a long pattern of this, but every time you see it, you just shudder because it's such a direct assault against democracy and the kind of procedures that we want to see followed in Washington.
Right, but the subtext here, the 900-pound gorilla in the living room, surely, Locke Johnson, is that there's a possibility that the President of the United States has committed treason, or even worse, he's somehow controlled by a case officer, as the former Director of National Intelligence, the country's top intelligence officer, said recently that he believes that Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's case officer.
Yes. Well, this is all very worrisome, to say the least, and we need to come to the bottom of it. But how shall we do it? I'm not sure, again, even though I championed Anne Feinstein, that releasing individual testimony on her own volition is necessarily the proper way to do it. We've got to really make sure that we do this with careful procedure and honoring the rules of the Senate and the House and releasing testimony. And we've got to, most of all, I think, put our efforts behind making sure that Mueller does a good job. He certainly has the skills for it and the history and the tradition and has a lot of wide respect in Washington. So the key to finding out whether or not Donald Trump is an agent of the Russian intelligence service or any of these important questions that we have to look at really depends, I think, on the special counsel's investigation. We've got to protect that by all means. And as we hear, there are rumors that the White House is trying to destroy that investigation and trying to rally Republicans like Grassley and Graham to help with that effort. And if that's true, then we're talking about Watergate proportions here.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Ann.
Again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he's the author of America's Secret Power and the Threat on the Horizon. And his latest book just out is Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's incredibly light work schedule that's just been released or just been leaked to Axios.
Getting paid by the hour and older by the minute. My boss just pushed me over the limit. I'd like to call him something. I think I'll just call it a day.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matthew Dalek, who's a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management and a political historian. He's the author of The Right Moment, Ronald Reagan's First Victory and the Decisive Turning Point in American Politics. And his most recent book is Defenseless Under the Night, The Roosevelt Years and the Origins of Homeland Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Dalek.
Thanks for having me.
And you quoted in the BBC in a discussion about the leak from, or the scoop, I guess, is what Axios is calling it, scooped Trump's secret shrinking schedule. And it turns out that Donald Trump only works basically from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the most. And there's an awful lot of executive time, which seems like a something of a euphemism, in there. And apparently the executive time is a euphemism for tweeting, watching TV, and making phone calls to friends. So this is an amazingly light schedule. We should all be so lucky, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's first of all, it's a little hard to know what's happening on weekends and nights, and you know, there could be events that intervene where, you know, that call something to his attention. But look, this schedule that Axios reported on, I think, is consistent with a lot of things of what we now know about how he conducts himself. The inattention to detail, the inability to focus on even the most rudimentary aspects of health or tax or other policy, the kind of chaos that we see his presidency embodied in his presidency, especially in his tweets. I mean, this reserves a lot of time for him to nurse his grievances, where he can sit and watch cable TV, he can tweet, he can maybe talk to some friends who can gin him up, and this unstructured time breeds chaos.
Well, it's usually presidents, the first thing they do in the morning is to get their intelligence briefings, and it looks as though Trump doesn't get his 11 a.m., and prior to that, he's the executive time, according to the schedules, are in the Oval Office. But in reality, apparently, the executive time in the morning is always in the residence, where he's watching TV, tweeting, and talking on the phone. They've got the schedule, Axios, for this week. And today, Tuesday, Trump has his first meeting of the day with Chief of Staff John Kelly at 11 a.m., and presumably there's some intelligence briefing there as well. And then he has executive time, again, a euphemism for watching TV, for an hour, followed by an hour lunch in the private dining room off the Oval Office. And then he has another 1 hour, 15 minutes of executive time, followed by a 45-minute meeting with National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, then another 15 minutes of executive time before Trump takes his last meeting of the day at 3:45 p.m. Eastern Time today, with the head of presidential personnel, Johnny DeStefano, before ending his official day at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Time today. So today is a pretty light schedule, right? Mm-hmm. With all what's going on in the world,
yeah.
I might add.
Yeah. Well, extremely light. And look, this is not to say there is no one single way to be an effective president in terms of managing schedule. I mean, President Jimmy Carter was famous for being a micromanager and being incredibly bright, some would even say brilliant. And yet he was widely seen as being ineffective at managing his staff and really being ineffective at managing his relationships with even members of his own party on Capitol Hill. Ronald Reagan, whom some have said and speculated about, especially in his last couple years, whether he had dementia or early onset of Alzheimer's. He was ridiculed sometimes for taking naps, for having a light schedule, sometimes nodding off in meetings. And yet he had a kind of ideological worldview, a sense of where often he wanted to go on particular issues, and was able to kind of delegate, I think, relatively effectively. What we're seeing, though, in Trump is, I think, worrisome. I mean, part of what I think it reflects is that there is a hostility between this White House and this president and the people in the executive branch and the national security bureaucracies. There is a sense that this so-called deep state, right, this sort of conspiratorial idea that there are all these deep state bureaucrats who are out to take Trump down, but that reflected in the schedule is a sense that he's got to be walled off from folks. A president typically might, say, make a major policy announcement at the Department of Health and Human Services or go to the CIA to talk to staff and career officials there. You know, this president, I think, has done very little, next to nothing of that. And I think that the schedule reflects just how kind of walled off he is, in a sense, from his own government, from the career people there, and also, to some extent, from reality.
So I just read today's schedule for President Trump in the White House, which was leaked to Axios, and we were just commenting that there was a pretty light day today. Thursday of this week's even lighter. The president has an especially light schedule with policy time at 11 a.m., then executive time at 12 p.m., then lunch for an hour, then more executive time from 1:30 p.m. to for the rest of the day. So, it's pretty amazing. Yeah. As a political historian, can you give us some comparisons, Matthew?
Sure. Well, again, every president is different. Presidents like to put out their schedules to send a message to the country about who they're meeting with, how hard they're working, the kind of discipline that they have brought to the office. But, you know, people like presidents like Bill Clinton, for example, who, especially in the first couple years, listened to a lot of different voices within the administration, often stayed up late, noodling on really important policy decisions. You know, I think some people made the argument that he was too undisciplined, right? That there was a lack of structure there, and that he was staying up too late, and so on. But you know, ultimately, it really worked for him. And I think most people, a lot of Americans, a lot of his staff, thought that he was very effective. George W. Bush was famous for being an early riser. He wanted his staff into the Oval Office, in the White House, and on, ready to go, 7 a.m., sometimes before that, 6:45 a.m., and he would knock off early, right? He did not like to go out at night or apparently work much at night, but he had a routine that he stuck to and that, you know, gave him a sense of comfort and kind of discipline. President Obama liked to go have dinner with his family because he had two girls he was raising in the White House along with his wife, First Lady Michelle Obama. So he liked to reserve that time for dinner, but then often he would go back to the West Wing or sometimes in the residence, and he would stay up pretty late reading, thinking, writing. So, you know, every president has a different kind of schedule. And look, there are some presidents who are overworked, right, and who it is not healthy for them psychologically, and it's not healthy for them in terms of their policy decisions, who, you know, are working 16, 18-hour days. But then there are others, and I think this is the case of Trump, where there appears to be such a lack of structure, such a lack of discipline, that it enables him, first of all, to talk to basically people who are friendly to him, you know, who kind of his loyalists, but also where he can kind of exist in a world of cable news and in some ways, you know, false information. And so, you know, he's walled off in a sense from a lot of the competing voices and serious information and policy debates that most other presidents are exposed to based on the schedule.
But isn't there something fundamentally strange about this schedule and the huge imbalance between actually working as President of the United States and leader of the free world and watching television about himself largely? This would this would be like if you're an actor. You're not interested in the performance. You're only interested in the reviews.
Yeah, well, I think imbalance, yes, but even more so dangerous, okay, because he exists in a world where if he is watching, let's say, Fox News, and they report on something about North Korea, or maybe they report something false about something that, you know, one of his critics said. Well, that then informs the president's ideas, his thinking, and then he tweets it out. And so what you get, I think, is not just chaos in policymaking, but sort of the utter absence of leadership, a kind of leadership vacuum at the top, to the point where, for example, he tweeted out a few months ago that he was going to ban transgender members of the military from serving. And he did that on Twitter with no consultation of the chiefs of staff or the military. His attacks on, for example, NFL players, right, who are kneeling during the singing of the national anthem, you know, it allows him to engage in a set of score settling and to kind of nurse his grievances, to act on those grievances, whether it's with North Korea or one of his critics. And it is remarkable. And again, the serious and hard, I mean, part of being president, there is a performance aspect to it, okay? And you know, but the imbalance is that Trump is so, you know, 90-95% focused on the performance, the theater of it, that the hard stuff, the policy substance is completely lost and it falls by the wayside.
Well, tomorrow, Wednesday, on Trump's schedule, he meets at 11 a.m. for his intelligence briefing. And then, of course, prior to that, he's in the residence tweeting, watching TV, and calling friends. And apparently he talks, according to this new book, Fire and Fury, he talks to Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox, regularly and often. So he starts at 11 a.m. in the Oval Office with an intelligence briefing. Then he has executive time until 2 p.m. when he has a meeting with Norway's prime minister. And then his last official duty is a video recording with Hope Hicks at 4 p.m. And I noticed that the author of this new book that's flying off the shelves, and he's being interviewed all over the place, Michael Wolff, he was on MSNBC last night, and he made the point that Hope Hicks actually is with Trump almost all the time that he's in the Oval, and she's with him more than anybody else. And he made the comment that she is his closest advisor. That, in she's 24 mm-hmm. years old, a model whose only experience has been judging clothing lines.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about her background in particular. And, you know, my sense is that he does not have, at this point, a single closest advisor. I mean, you know, John Kelly is clearly influential, McMaster, the national security advisor, Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. These are people who carry at least some weight, I think, in policy decisions. And you have, of course, his daughter and son-in-law, Ivanka and Jared Kushner. So, you know, it's unclear, you know, if there – I don't think there is a single person who is sort of pushing his buttons. Having said that, though, you know, the schedule, and I think the way he conducts himself, it has fed over the past year in particular into the charge from his critics that he is unfit, you know, that he is simply incapable of doing the work of being president in a way that you can't really compare to any other president. Now, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is that, you know, he simply is so chaotic. He's so, you know, undisciplined that the ability to kind of focus on the work of actually governing the country and leading the country is so beyond him. And so what he does is he reverts to, you know, flaming people on Twitter or retweeting, you know, one of his followers' tweets that shows a Trump train running over CNN, you know. He'll attack, you know, Mika Brzezinski and, you know, charge that she got a face job or something and how terrible she looks. And that he'll engage in these kind of incredibly mean-spirited and you know, petty attacks that really have nothing to do with leading the country and with governing. And to the point where his own Republican leadership in Congress often has no idea what he's going to do or where he's going to come down on an issue. So I think, you know, the schedule fills out a piece of this larger and very troubling picture.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Matthew Dalek, just to sort of pull back and look at the broader issue of separation of power and where this president stands in history, since you're a presidential historian, it would seem to me that you could make the case that not only do you have a dysfunctional executive branch with a kind of absentee landlord who spends more time watching television than he does governing and doesn't seem to have much interest in governing, then you have a legislative branch that is basically not acting as a check and balance on the executive branch. They seem to have completely, particularly after this meeting on the weekend in Camp David with the Republican leaders of the House and Senate, they seem to have entirely thrown their lot in with Trump. And my sense is that what's really going on here is that Paul Ryan and McConnell and the powerful donors to the Republican Party, like the Koch brothers and others, are perfectly happy with this president. Because he is so weak and so disorganized and therefore depends on them and basically gives them a free hand. And for reasons that I don't know, and maybe you have some insight into it, they have decided to throw their lot in with him. They're going to try and scuttle or limit or frustrate or sabotage the Mueller inquiry to try and defend him. So I don't want to be too cynical here, but my sense is that they like this guy being in the office. He's the perfect absentee landlord for them because it means it gives them a free hand, and he'll sign anything they put on his desk.
Yeah, I think a lot of people on the right, including the Republican congressional leadership, are happy that he has governed more as a conservative, as they define it. So he has not, you know, blown up a ton of trade deals. Or automatically, you know, tried to rescind NAFTA, for example, or and what they've been able to do and to see is that, look, he appointed Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, someone they very much like. He has gutted a number of Obama-era regulations. He has supported the evisceration of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, even though they were unable to do it. And on tax cuts, he championed this massive tax reform package that is primarily aimed at corporations and the wealthiest people in the country. So on the policy issues, I think that they, by and large, think that they align with him and that they can kind of that his agenda is also Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's agenda. Where I think they're unhappy with him is that, well, a couple levels. One is they realize that their political fate is tied to him, and they do not like how unpopular he is. Because with his approval ratings in the mid 30% in the country, they are very worried that they're going to lose one or both chambers of Congress. So, but at the same time, they are shackled. And this is not to defend it or justify it, it's just to try to explain what their calculation is. They are tied to Trump. He's got, you know, 80-plus percent approval ratings among Republicans. They need him to provide them essentially with cover to try to kind of save their majorities in this upcoming midterm election. And so they need to kind of buttress him politically. And I think that's what explains in part the meeting at Camp David, the tributes to Trump's brilliant leadership that you're hearing from other Republicans, the efforts to kind of stand Trump up, because they realize that, you know, if Trump cannot, you know, improve his poll ratings, if he sinks even lower, it is it threatens their political majorities. And that's why I think you've seen this kind of marriage of convenience in a sense. But, you know, from the reporting I've read privately, and this is inevitable with presidents and their congressional majorities in the same party, right? I mean, you know, Democrats in Congress, when they had the majorities in 2009, 2010, were often frustrated with the new president, Barack Obama. But this, I think, the private conversations, I think they are probably in many ways disdainful. They don't trust President Trump, and they wish that he was not so unfit and unstable, but they are stuck with him, and now they're backing him to the hilt.
So they don't like his antics, but they like his agenda.
They like his agenda. I think some of them worry that these are not just antics, but that these are antics, but these are dangerous. You know, his
sure.
behavior is dangerous for the country. And we've heard a couple of them who are now not running for re-election, Senators Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, express those views openly. My sense is that many more Republicans in Congress believe that privately, but they won't, of course, say so.
Well, Matthew Dalek, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Dalek, who's a professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management and a political historian. He's the author of The Right Moment, Ronald Reagan's First Victory and the Decisive Turning Point in American Politics. And his most recent book is Defenseless Under the Night, The Roosevelt Years and the Origins of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a psychiatrist who thinks that the new book, Fire and Fury, adds to the problem that there's too much focus and expectation on the wish to remove Trump from office because he is mentally unfit and not enough attention to the fact that he's a very bad man doing very bad things. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Very nice to be back with you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Francis. And obviously, with the release of this book by Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury, which is flying off the shelves, there is a great deal of attention now to Trump's mental state, which is written about extensively, quoting all kinds of aides. Apparently, the consensus amongst everybody working in the White House for Trump or with Trump is that he's like a child, that he has kind of tantrums and an attention span of a child, etc. So more and more we're getting this sort of psychiatric diagnosis, albeit amateur ones. So as a professional psychiatrist, I know you've been concerned for some time that we're sort of missing the forest for the trees, in the sense that we're looking at this man's mental state as opposed to who he is as a person, and that he's a very bad man doing very bad things, and that's what we should be paying attention to. So how has the Michael Wolff book affected your original thesis?
Well, it's remarkable to me that anyone could be surprised. Trump acted like an idiot in his 20s. He acted like an idiot in his 30s, in his 40s, in his 50s. He ran for president acting like an idiot. He's been bankrupt 5 different times. He's believed in conspiracy theories that were outrageous. He's never told the truth if he could possibly lie. He's never read a book. The American people elected this person. And I guess that one of the forms of buyer's remorse is to suddenly be surprised that, having elected an idiot, he's acting like an idiot. I think that the concern I have is not only that we're missing the deeper issues of what Trump's doing to the country, but that we're missing the fact that institutionally our democracy is being challenged, and so far it's failing, that the issue isn't Donald Trump. He's just a symptom of the disease. He's not the disease itself. He's a mirror on our soul, and it's a very ugly image, and that we have progressed over the last 50 years to a position in which the most extreme and radical policies that were castigated by conservative Republicans, like William Buckley, the father of American conservatism, policies that were castigated by him as being radically extreme 50 years ago now govern the Republican Party, and that the Republican Congress is not stepping up to the plate and doing whatever they can do to contain Trump, and instead they're enabling him in every way possible, that in sort of lockstep, sycophantic fashion, they're praising him as an amazing leader. They're trying their best to disqualify the legitimate Mueller investigations into his possible corruption. And most important, they're not doing the things they need to do to keep his itchy trigger finger off the nuclear button or carelessly starting a war with North Korea. We should be joining together as a country to protect ourselves from the extremes of Trump. We should be, as a society, looking within to try to gain insight on how an idiot like this could be elected president. And we should be doing our very best to exert our efforts towards 218 to elect a Congress that's more responsive to the people than to the billionaire donors who have taken over our government. So I worry about the preoccupation with Trump, with Trump's motivations, with Trump's last tweets, with Trump's psychiatric diagnosis. And meanwhile, the country is being degraded by policies, tax policies that are obviously a scam to enrich those who are already excessively enriched, to a cynical GOP agenda that's willing to put up with a dangerous president in the service of their billionaire donors.
Well, that seems to be what's really happening here, surely, Dr. Francis, and that is that you could make the case that Donald Trump is the perfect president for America's oligarchy of the Koch brothers and Robert Mercer and these other big donors, and that basically Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan have a completely free hand. Trump doesn't read anything. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't care. They're just pushing through everything that they can, and they've clearly, after that meeting this weekend in Camp David, they're throwing their lot in with him entirely, not just satisfied with an absentee landlord in the executive branch, but they are going further now. They're joining the cover-up to protect Trump against the Mueller investigation by destroying the reputation of Mueller, by purging the FBI and the Department of Justice.
I think the only question is a really interesting one, is who's a better face for the anti-democratic forces that have gained such power over our country, Trump or someone like Pence? Trump has the advantage of providing reality show bait and switch, so that people are so preoccupied with him that they don't notice the fact that a tax bill has been passed that will benefit only the super wealthy and provide a tremendous tax burden for our children and grandchildren and deprive people of medical coverage. But that's hidden from view, and even the Democratic Party didn't do anything in effective opposition to this tax bill because of the preoccupation with Trump and Trump's person. Or whether they would be better off with Pence and with a more plausible, less dramatic presentation of the same policies. I think we'll find out how the donors feel. Trump is propped up now only because of Rupert Murdoch, the Mercers, and the Kochs. If they pulled in their support from him, if they ever decided that he was a liability, he'd be gone. And the main reason he is propped up by them, which he cleverly, and he's crazy like a fox, which he cleverly exploits, is that 35%, so far at least, hardcore group of supporters. And these are people who are, many of them, quite extreme. The word deplorable comes to mind for many of them, in their willingness to sacrifice the values of American democracy in their support of Trump. So that at some point, it will be interesting to see whether the billionaire oligarchs who control the Republican Party, whether they decide to continue with Trump or whether they switch horses in 2020 or before. But for now, at least, what we've discovered is that he has been a remarkably successful vehicle for policies that are destroying our environment, that are depleting our resources, that are throwing us into conflict with our allies and possibly a wag-the-dog war with North Korea, and that the Republican Party is filled with remarkably cynical people who, fully aware, as I'm sure they are, of his limitations and dangers, are willing to throw in their lot with him to get blood money tax cuts to the very wealthy. And the risks that he presents to our country now, to the rest of the world, and our children for the future, are insignificant in their calculations compared to the fact that they're getting donor money and support for policies that really advantage the very few and disadvantage the rest of us.
My concern, Dr. Francis, is that the Democrats, and after all, you know, we're talking about a majority of Americans, 65%, because Trump's roughly got about 35% living in the Fox News bubble, who have been conditioned to believe that everything else in the media is fake news and only what Fox and Breitbart and Sinclair put out is the truth. So that obviously on the surface, there's a majority. So you could make the case that we are afflicted by a tyranny of the minority at the moment. And we have a dysfunctional executive branch and a completely derelict legislative branch that's not a check and balance against Trump. They're an enabler, as you've made clear. So I don't understand why liberals and Democrats think that a book by this Michael Wolff is going to drive this guy out of the Oval Office. My sense is that the ghost of Roy Cohn inhabits the Oval Office. This man, Trump, is a criminal, a gangster. He hangs out with mob types, which Roy Cohn represented. He's ruthless, he's heartless, he's corrupt, and authoritarian leaders do not go easy into that good night. They hold on to power. We've seen that from the Arab Spring. So I don't think they're going to pry this guy out of that Oval Office very easily, and certainly not by a book.
Well, I think the Democrats were weak in victory with Obama and are pathetic in defeat now with Trump. I cannot for the life of me understand why they didn't develop their own health plan that would have been in competition to the Republican plan and present to the American people that our plan will cut costs by reducing the ridiculous pricing and will continue to cover people without increased premiums. Their plan is to allow the providers to get away with pricing murder and reduce coverage, which do the American people want? With a tax bill. Why didn't they have an alternative tax bill? Why didn't they shut down the government? Why did they allow this tax bill to go through? They could have made a very compelling case that they were protecting America from the oligarchs. I think that there should have been demonstrations before the Congress addressed the medical bill and the tax bill in Washington, and there was nothing. The Republican Party has been much more powerful and effective in its propaganda. I think that the future depends almost exclusively on 2018. There is absolutely no chance in the world that Pence and the cabinet will find the president unfit to continue in his office. And then two-thirds of each house of the Congress would also have to agree with that assessment. There is absolutely no chance in the world that mental illness will be a ground for removal. And there's very little chance that impeachment will be grounds for removal. I'm not even sure removal would make sense because we get Pence, who's probably in some ways much more dangerous. So I think that the focus has to be on retaking the Democratic institutions that have been perverted. And certainly everyone should be doing anything they can. People shouldn't be screaming at the TV set. They should be getting out there and helping get out to vote in 2018. I don't think there's been, everyone always says this is a crucial election. We have had in our history very few crucial elections. This happens to be one. Even though it's a midterm election, I think it will set the tone for 2020. I think 2020 will not only be a ballot about who's president, it will also be who controls the gerrymandering for the next decade. And the Republicans really took over our country through clever gerrymandering. The only way it can be taken back is victories in these next two elections.
And do you think that if Trump fires the special counsel, Robert Mueller, taking to the streets will work, will be sufficient? Because in the winter, it's not exactly inviting. My sense is that may well be in the cards. Again, I go back to the thesis that Trump is basically a criminal, a kleptocrat, and an authoritarian, and he's playing by completely different rules, and we're very flat-footed because we're used to a certain degree of decorum and tradition in politics in this country, and this guy has broken all the china.
I think exactly my point stated better than I could say it. That basically, calling him crazy underestimates his being crazy like a fox and underestimates the danger he represents. I think he will fire Mueller in one form or another. It'll be interesting to see how much Mueller has on him, but my guess is there'll be enough so he will fire him, will try to discredit him, and that the Republicans will cover for it. And that the only way the situation, the dynamic could change is at the ballot box. I don't think that the Democrats complaining about this will have much impact. I think that they've set the stage for discrediting Mueller, and they'll be using all the propaganda tools to make it seem like the corruption and collusion with Russia is not a big deal, but that the Mueller investigation somehow has overstepped its boundaries, the kind of Orwellian newspeak reversal. And I don't think people will take to the streets. I think what they need to do is take the ballot box. So having a Democratic House, which increasingly looks possible, having the investigative tools of the Congress pointed more at the president's behavior than at a continuing ridiculous investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails in Benghazi, I think that that would help to improve public awareness. I think there's certain people who will go to hell with Trump. They'll walk through the gates of hell with Trump. And they include the alt-right, the misogynists, the racists, the anti-Semites. They include the cynical politicians. He'll be hand-in-hand with McConnell and Ryan as they walk to the gates of hell. And they include the billionaires who are supporting them. I think that a certain percentage of that 35% will be softer as time goes on. At least I hope it will be. I think it doesn't make sense for people who lose their medical coverage because of Trump to continue supporting Trump. And I think some of the people in that position will realize this. I think it doesn't make sense for people who care about America, who are patriots, to support a man who was willing to collude with Russia, in many ways a clear, long-term enemy of our best interests, willing to collude with our enemy in order to get elected. I think some patriots will fall away from that 35%. And it puzzles me that evangelicals can be 80% behind Trump, that Jesus Christ was the exact antithesis of Trump. Trump is kind of an antichrist. His disrespect, contempt for the poor contrasts sharply with Jesus' emphasis on charity. Jesus was thinking about Trump when he said that it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than a camel through the eye of a needle. And Jesus hated religious hypocrites. He was not capable of much hate, but when it came to religious hypocrites, he could speak strongly. And I think the evangelical leaders who sold their soul to Trump fall into that category of religious hypocrites, focusing on their own political power and money, focusing on abortion and gay love, issues that Christ did not care about, never preached a word against either abortion or gay love, even though both were common in the Roman Empire in which he lived. So I think that there's hope that amongst people who lose economically because of Trump, amongst patriots who worry about his willingness to court enemies and attack the FBI and our security agents for his own personal interest, and amongst religious people who are really Christian, not the fake Christians that are leading the evangelical movement, there's hope that those numbers will drop. And if Trump's numbers drop, his value to the GOP and to the rich billionaire donors decreases, and his ability to push through really dangerous policies to ruin our government with the most hideous appointments, to pervert the courts for the next 30 or 40 years with totally ideological incompetence, that reduces to the degree that he has less power to sway the 35% to continued support. He understands this, and that's why his public pronouncements seem so crazily extreme. He's not talking to America. He's not representing America at this point. He's representing the small, most deplorable element of our population. And his appeals are intended to keep that support in line, because he realizes that without it, he'll probably be abandoned by the Republican Party and its donors.
Well, just in closing, we can at least have some, we don't want to be too depressed here, we can at least take some encouragement from the actions today by Senator Feinstein, who's normally been considered quite cautious. She's unilaterally released the transcripts of the Fusion GPS co-founders' testimony that Senator Grassley, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, has been sitting on, and he's been pursuing Hillary right. Clinton and uranium and emails and all of that insanity instead of releasing the transcripts, which I understand basically give some insight into the Steele dossier and verify a lot of its content. So that's, I think, an encouraging sign, don't you think?
I think the Democrats have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a meeting with lawyers about, this is just before the Obama primary with Hillary Clinton, and 11 of them were Republicans, and one other was a Democrat. And we fought them as best we could. And then he turned on me, because he was for Hillary and I was for Obama. And he said, you know, you're a naive idiot. Hillary Clinton will be able to fight these people. Barack Obama won't. She knows the skeletons in the closet. She knows how to push the right buttons. He doesn't. I have tremendous admiration for Obama as a human being. I think he's a noble person. But I have to be disappointed with him as president. It was on his watch that the election to Trump was lost. He could have swung that election by indicating that the Russians were backing Trump. He didn't do it. He didn't fight at the local level for the state houses around the country. He didn't really, on his watch, America went very far to the right, 33 state houses, 33 legislatures controlled by the GOP. I think part of the problem was he fought clean. And I think the Democrats have got to take their gloves off. And in this next election, they have to be willing to release documents. They have to be willing to meet outrageous, radical efforts on the Republican Party to divert resources to the rich with very strong policy. They have to defend Obamacare much more strongly than they have. And we, the people, have to step up. So far, the press has done a great job in exposing Trump. But we, the people, haven't. We've been sitting back and complaining about his diagnosis instead of demonstrating in Washington. And the Democratic Party has been a tremendous disappointment. And I think that the next election requires on-the-ground work from all of us to ensure that we get a majority in the House and possibly a majority in the Senate, although that's a long shot. Because if we don't have the people in Washington representing us, we the people, they'll be representing the billionaires and people who support Trump.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller, Saving Normal, and the reference work, Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Now.